A man tries to reconnect with his daughter during the COVID outbreak of 2020, and two young high schoolers get their identities mixed up, and the bad guy becomes the good guy, and the good guy becomes the bad guy, as we have Dougie Doug with us talking about In the Weeds and Class Act here on Overdue Rentals. Welcome back to Overdue Rentals, everybody. My name is Matthew Schuckman, and I apologize. You're not going to hear anything on the other side because, unfortunately, due to some scheduling issues, Mike couldn't be here with us today. So you just have me. And of course, though, you also have Doug Eat Doug with us coming up in a second to talk to us about his new film that he stars in, co-directed, co-written, co-produced, In the Weeds, which is premiering this weekend here in New York at the Harlem Film Festival. But while I had him here, I couldn't help but not want to talk about 1992's Class Act, which to me, sorry, everybody, I know this is going to upset some people, better than the House Party movies, as far as kid and play movies go. And I, that's one of those movies that I could not wait for that for it to come on. Every time I turned on the TV, I was hoping that Class Act would be on. Is that The Last Dragon, probably Raising Arizona, and you know, a few others, but like there's a handful of films when they came on HBO when I was a kid that was that's what I'm watching, can't wait for it. So we had to talk about Class Act here as our Overdue Rental, so I won't waste much of your time right now. I'll come back and meet you after, but first let's get Dougie Doug in here to talk about In the Weeds and Class Act. Dougie Doug, come on in. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is a true honor and a pleasure to be speaking with you, by the way. So,
Thank you.
So I want to start just by talking about In the Weeds here, because, you know, with a lot, like this is with a lot of films, you know, you could take this and take it out of the COVID pandemic and still be as poignant as you are with the story. So what made you want, was it just the idea of what you had to go through that, or what people went through that you wanted to do it and put that setting in there? Or is there another reason why it was specifically set in COVID settings?
It was set in COVID because it was conceptualized during the pandemic. And I mean, it might've been maybe about six or seven months in, but we were still kind of getting almost out of lockdown and there was talk of vaccines and so forth. And so that's why that's the backdrop. It was like, yeah. Okay, so what, how can we tell a story under these circumstances? And of course we wanted to put the pandemic in the background. That was our choice, you know? So that's why it's there are allusions to it and people, it's more about how people are affected.
Yes.
Than it's about COVID, you know?
Well, you know, and go ahead.
Loss and change and so forth.
Of course. And not to harp on the idea any longer too, but it is something that I also was interested in knowing that as time though progressed, were there things that were fed in a little bit more just because, again, unfortunately, a lot of the issues we deal with on a personal level today, what people think is new, but it's not. It's always happening all the time. It's just kind of hyper-realized and spread because of social media. But there were things like that interaction you had with the delivery guy at the beginning kind of mirror a lot of the things you see, you know, where you get, you know, both situations are happening on both sides, which one's real and one's not, where one person's saying one thing, the other person's saying it not. So did a lot of, again,
exactly.
Yeah. Was there a lot of like input coming from like what's happening in the world again, as time went on, that you had kind of get fed back into the script?
Totally. It was totally subtext about, you know, the sort of misunderstandings and different points of view. Like even my friend Clay, who co-directed with me, you know, he plays the guy who is yelling at me and we were like, should this be like a racial profiling thing? And he was just like, and we were like, no, this is so much better with people thinking it's really like two human beings who are really in two different places and it could end up turning into anything. Which I think that's how messy and confusing life can be sometimes, you know.
It's also something where there's again, you know, without trying to speak too specifically for people who haven't seen the movie yet, and I don't want to give anything away.
Right.
You know, but as you know, Larry's kind of going through his own thing day in and day out, whether it's people he's meeting on the street who he doesn't know, or you know, I forgot to write it down. He saw running across the park, his friend's name was Dre's? Was
Dez.
Dez, thank you, sorry, Dez. I knew it was D and S. stuff like that. But again, he knew him, you know, they have family connections, but people are not kind of wanting to be open because they've dealt with Larry about this so many times now that they're kind of like, they almost feel like, what can I say to him at that point?
Exactly. It's really interesting because I think it's a very typical kind of dynamic, particularly where a person is really troubled, but they're still trying to function. And they don't know that they're giving off toxic vibes. they're struggling to live, you know. I thought we found that very interesting to, you know, it's not a situation where a person is really, nor the audience, nor that person is completely conscious of what's bothering them. And then people are in their lives are kind of, like you said, they don't know, they may be afraid of him. They don't know what he might do, you know? So that was definitely, we're playing with those tensions to your point.
Yeah, and not to, you know, I didn't even think about it till right now, and especially the way you said it, and I'm not trying to harp on specifically on just current events, but you think about the whole Jordan Neely thing, and it's very similar because he's not bothering anybody. Yeah, he may be being brash and loud in a way, but he didn't approach anybody, and then you end up with somebody who thought that, you know, oh, he's going to hurt somebody, right?
Yes. I mean, particularly, you know, I was very hyper conscious of the fact that obviously I'm a Black male and there are racial fears that sometimes are part of interactions. And it's a question of how can this be a tipping point for good things and bad things? You know, how can people, how do people distinguish between who a person is and what they're perceived to be, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, it feels weird because I say it way too much, I think, but it's how I feel. It's like, you know, like for as much as younger generation especially considers themselves things like along the lines of empaths, I think empathy itself is something that's kind of dying in a way, and people don't get it. Like, you don't have to agree with people. You don't have to be on their side. You never have to defend what they're saying, but to understand where it comes from is the key to kind of open up the right dialogue to get those things fixed.
Absolutely. I do think there's a lot of misunderstanding about empathy. It's almost like the use of the word empathy is interesting because it's almost like compassion light. It's like, I try to explain this to my own children that there are levels of awareness about people's experience. And so, yeah, to just have a feeling for humanity in general is wonderful. However, it takes a certain level of investment and commitment to people to really try to get into the nuances and develop and cultivate that empathy, you know, so that you become compassionate, you know.
No, very, very much so. And, you know, honestly, we could probably go on forever talking about it, but I feel that, like, as much as it is important to talk about it, we'd get so lost in it. So I do want to ask. I do want to ask about your relationship, your working relationship with Clayton too, because it's not your first rodeo together. But when it comes to doing like the feature length here, you know, where does the balance fit? Is one of you doing more of what you consider the typical directing job, and the other's more the typical producing, writing, so on and so forth?
Great question. We both have very specific kinds of expertise, and we just seem to kind of balance each other very well and complement each other very well. Like, I was primarily concerned with the actors and performance. He's a very technical guy. So he has a mastery over the visual dimensions and the technical dimensions and the camera work and so forth. And I am very much focused on meaning and themes. So when we write, I focus on like, what is this about? What are people's motivations? And he writes set pieces very well. He writes, you know, he conceptualizes characters very well. So we there's so much to be done. This is my second time co-directing with someone, and I think I've had the best kind of division of labor with Clay, because we just have different sensibilities, different points of view. It's really one of those advantages to differences. And that's one of the things I like to promote about not only our relationship, but the movie, is that I think it's richer because of our differences. And it's sort of a testament to how people who are different backgrounds, different whatever, those are probably superficial. We're both film fanatics and we're both New Yorkers. So that's really what it is, you know.
I'm also interested in the, you know, the very specific idea of the in the weeds, because, you know, going into it, you know, I like to go into things as blind as I can, but I did see the poster, so you can see kind of, you know, the actual literal weeds, which you do get these introductions to through Shantae's, you know, overdubs. And I'm wondering, was there also, you know, as much as the film's about these personal relationships and loss and all these other things, was there a point where you're just like trying to decide, do I do that story first? Or my first interest was this kind of like this idea of these other things out there that can help us, that can guide us, that people are just overlooking, and then it grows from there.
Yeah, it started off with the experience, the inner life and the plight of the characters. And then we started thinking about solutions, potential solutions. And we were looking to our own lives, you know, and the ways that we were trying to cope with the increase of stress and the and what we were witnessing in the lives of people around us. And so people, we were like kind of doing some research, and some people were turning to, you know, sort of natural methods. And obviously there was meditation and so forth, so on. So it kind of sprung out of the plight of the characters, you know.
And, you know, go ahead, sorry.
And also the main thing was that we witnessed people going out to natural spaces during that period. And so we were like, oh, okay, yeah, this is something that people are yearning for that maybe they're not even aware.
Yeah.
It's helping us survive this thing, you know.
Yeah, you know what? It's when you say it like that too, it's like it's kind of so obvious, and I'm kind of ashamed that I kind of didn't connect that a little bit earlier myself. But
yeah.
Oh, God, sorry. I mean,
it's understandable, because it was something that I think that a lot of people were doing. They were literally doing naturally.
You know, here at Over Durentals, we do love to talk about films also, though, that we feel, you know, at one point had so much behind them as far as, you know, public talk, and now people don't talk about them enough. And for me, 1992's Class Act is a film that I think people don't talk about anymore, that they should. I don't know why. And it's one of those things where, look, we all loved House Party and House Party. I mean, people love House Party 3 as well. To me, House Party 1 and 2 are kind of it, personally, not trying to talk down. But, you know, what I love about Class Act so much is because we were so used to the whole kid and play thing. And by then, that movie is made by the supporting cast. It's made by you and people like Lamont Johnson. That makes that movie. And I'm just kind of wondering, when you come into something like that again, because it's like, oh, well, it's the new kid and play movie. Yes. Do you feel like you're a guest coming in, or you feel like you get free reign? I could do what I want.
I did not feel like a guest, because the director, and mostly Kid, embraced me and welcomed me and made me feel like I could do whatever I wanted to do. Because most of my lines are ad-libbed in that movie. And, you know, I actually was performing as stand-up at the Apollo Theater. I bumped into Play, and he said, oh, you know, we got to work together. And I'm like, okay, sure, you know, but I didn't, you know. I was like, oh, people say that stuff like that all the time. So I had the endorsement of everybody to just do it. Because, you know, that was the sort of formula of Kid and Play movies. They had always had the sidekick comedian, you know, Martin Lawrence did it in one movie, this one did it. So I was that guy, you know. So they were very respectful of comedians and their ability to, you know, extemporaneously yuck. So Yeah, it was a lot. I'm thank you for mentioning that movie. I love that.
It's one of the, it's, that's the, like, the whole idea behind this podcast when we started it was the idea that, like, I can remember when every, it was Saturday Night Live, The Simpsons, and every show was, like, aping on the hot movie of the day, and, like, things like Run, Lola, Run, you know, like, which the people don't get those references when they watch those shows kind of referencing them now, and I'm like, Class Act, like, granted, again, House Party was a big thing, but I got most excited when Class Act came on HBO. That's what I was waiting for. And honest, I'll be honest with you, I watched it constantly, waiting to get to the point where you guys are at the Wax Museum at the end.
That thing is brilliant. That's brilliant, dude.
I will say, you. Well, first of all, your runoff when you got the Three Stooges next to you is one of the greatest things still to this day I've ever seen.
Thank you. I like the classic comedy set pieces and stuff like that. I mean, you know, really cool.
I was rewatching it though, and I will say that I think there was a, well, I mean, I don't know, but like, they maybe couldn't cast them and it didn't work, but I think there was a missed joke because the idea when you all walk in and you thought the Alex Trebek stand up was Chuck Woolery, and then later on Wedge says it's I can't remember who Wedge said it was, but then Ming's like, no, that's Jimmy Swagger. And McMurray instead on the quiz at the end was played by Alex Trebek, and then you and the kid, well, that's Chuck Woolery. Would have been the best joke, but
that's a good point.
I guess it couldn't have happened.
Exactly. I didn't think of it at the time.
Is there then though, like, again, since most of that's you ad-libbing though, is there like a lost reel of just like you going off forever and we just haven't seen it yet?
I'm sure.
I also have to ask, you know, like, I guarantee it's not. I can, watching it, I can tell, like, you know, there's that one shot of you or your character during that car chase scene at the end. I guarantee there's probably a stunt double in there. They probably wouldn't let you in there. Did they let you ride in that car at all during that?
A little bit, but not really. Yeah.
Well, it's the reason I bring it up is because I probably didn't notice it until now, you know, rewatching it as an older person. But granted, it only lasts for maybe like, you know, a minute or two, but like the end of that car chase scene is actually brilliantly put together. And there's kind of stuff that you don't get even in action movies today that you guys pulled off then in a very slick way.
Yeah, because remember, that was a time when people used actual cars as opposed to CG.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they, you know, the Warner Brothers, you know, they had, you know, it's a Warner Brothers film, so they had a lot of, you know, old school stunt people. And back, you know, back when we made movies those days, those guys were, you know, they had enormous stature on the lots, you know, so they were the boss when these stunts were happening. So I enjoyed that part of movie making. I'm sorry that now, I mean, I love digital stuff, but, you know,
yeah,
the whole culture of individuals, you know, that used to be very prominent that are not as prominent.
Well, is there some solace in the idea of being filmmaker yourself and being behind the camera? And I mean, again, it's not the first time, but being behind the camera now more often than earlier in your career, that, you know, granted, hey, you know, if I can pay a few hundred dollars and get something done without having to be as practical about it, it's great, I can get it done. But having kind of that control over whether you want it done or not.
It's true. It is an advantage in terms of realizing a vision more succinctly, but it's also, sort of is a loss as well. You know. There's something about the culture of a set when you have working class guys that are working for a living, and I just like the idea of it being this community of people who are different. Now there's a lot of, you know, geeky fellows. they run the world again.
Yeah, you know, it's obviously everything is cylindrical, but, you know, it's,
yes,
I guess, finding that sweet spot where it's like, look, I know we're not in a perfect space, but we're in a happier, calmer space, and we're getting things done the way we like them, is not such a bad thing.
No, not at all. And I like geeky guys, so I don't want to mean to suggest I'm putting them down. I'm a geeky guy, so, you know.
We all are. I mean, look at this. I mean, I consider all this crap geeky. A lot of people don't. I do. I don't know.
Right.
But
yeah, we're just enthusiastic about what we care about, and that's how I see it.
Yeah, I have music and I have movies. Those are my mainline things. When I find something I like, I grasp onto it. Like that's why, yeah. Like, yeah, I like this very popular thing that you like as well. It's great. I had a fun time, but it's not as meaningful as those few things that really do it right.
It's true. It's true.
Do you, and I have to let you go in a second. So I just want to, I want to go back. Cause again, you know, you're working with Clayton and some other people co-directing, co-writing, co-producing. Is there a desire to just kind of be the singular person behind something in the future?
Maybe. I my first movie, I was like the sole guy, and it was just so, I nearly had a nervous breakdown. Mm. So I'm a little concerned about that. I'm like, no man is an island, you know, that's the way I see it now.
Dougie, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It was wonderful talking with you.
My pleasure. Bye, Matthew.
Have a great night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Oh my, that's a pleasure. Look, there are people, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, from the early 90s or late 80s, will automatically connect Doug to Cool Runnings more than anything else. And rightfully so, again, because again, Cool Runnings is also another great movie that we all love, whether or not the story went exactly as it did in real life, because apparently, from what I understand, they were a lot more welcomed than they seemed in the movie version at the Olympics. They didn't kind of get heat from Sweden or anybody else at the time, but it's still a great movie. Not an overdrendle in my opinion, unfortunately, though, because luckily it is something that is endured in the minds of people then and now. So I wasn't going to talk to him about that, even though I would love to talk to him about Cool Runnings. Who wouldn't? But Class Act is a movie, as you heard me talk to him about, like, it's something where Kid and Play do their things. Like, you know what you're going to get from them in the movie world at this point. And everybody else in this movie, and I'm not trying to say they did bad or they're not worth it or anything like that. You know, please, I'm not trying to talk down about them in any way or the performances, but everybody else in this movie bought something special. I mean, real special. And, you know, again, specifically talking about Dougie Doug and Lamont Johnson, mainly because, you know, that, and he was the only one to kind of bring that manic energy at first to it. And it seems a little timeless. Like, then it may have seemed perfect, but as it goes on, you realize it's still perfect. Like, that you could have plucked that character out of that movie, put him in something modern, and it still would have fit. And then Lamont Johnson, who plays kind of the first and then more minor bad guy, Wedge, man, this guy didn't get enough credit. I think, you know, he's got a lot of work and a lot of things people love him from, but it, you know, the 90s archetype for these types of comedies was very outrageous, very, you know, unrealistic in a lot of ways. And it's never going to be realistic, but like really unrealistic. But the level of understanding that they bought to their performances and to the story is kind of special, because they do that. They do that kind of almost Looney Tune-esque, hyper-real performance, but at the same time, it's very grounded and very real. And it's not out of the lines too far. It's not something where somebody decided to be like, well, I'm going to be really ridiculous and just be so foolish that it, you know, it's kind of slapstick silly. Even though there are slapstick things that happen, the way they're done in this movie are perfect. And, you know, I can point to so many things and just, you know, talk about how much I love them. Like, there's a scene in the movie where Wedge is, they're chasing, well, they're trying to chase, they can't find him. They're chasing after our heroes. And he's got Mink, who is his drug pin boss, next to him in the car. He's kind of getting his gun ready. He's trying to load his gun. And he goes, like, do you have any extra bullets? And Wedge goes, yeah, I think so. He's like, well, do you, or don't you? He's like, yeah, no, I definitely do. And then he just, he, you know, I'm just like, no, I don't. And it's like so deflating and defeating in a real way that it's actually really funny. And I couldn't help but laugh out loud even while rewatching, even though I know what's coming. It was just so perfect. And I couldn't get past it. I kept thinking about it. I replayed it as I was rewatching it like a few times because it was too good. And then there's also later on, there's great stuff during the whole movie. You can't help it. But as I was talking to Doug about that car chase scene, maybe even 30 seconds, not even a minute, but 30 seconds of it is just so brilliantly done, because they, throughout the entire movie, for Blade's car, Blade, who plays character, played by, you know, Christopher Martin's his real name, they talk about the hydraulics in the back of the car and how this, you know, basically hatchback on a 4x4 in essence, you know, it moves in every direction. It just goes up, goes sideways, and they use it during this car chase. And all of a sudden, it's just like kids hanging off it at the time. You know, again, it's a stunt double, and the hydraulics work perfectly. So where he's running a little bit, and then it pulls him up, and it's like not focused on in a way where it's like trying to be flashy, but it's so real and so perfect, and it works so well. And then right after he recovers, it comes to this part where, again, with Wedge driving and Mick next to him and some thugs in the back, they're kind of weaving in and out through construction site under a bridge. So there are columns from this bridge that are in the way, and they're trying to dodge around them and swerve around them. And as they're doing it, you completely lose sight of Blade's car, and it's done POV from their drive from Wedge and Mink's, you know, perspective, where you actually lose the car, like, and it's in frame. It's like, you, where, how did it just disappear? It was right in front of me, and it's done so well, you know. And not only just for, you know, not only for a comedy from the early 90s, but, you know, comedy that probably in a lot of ways was not specifically trying to be flashy in any way whatsoever. And again, it's almost like a snap that this section goes by, and then it ends in a more ridiculous manner, of course. But for like a good 30 seconds, that's some like expert car chase filmmaking that really should be seen more often. You know, it doesn't have to be cars hitting each other and bursting into flames and Fast and Furious style. It's impressive. And I don't think I caught it until this watch of the film. And it's really good. It's so good. Look, I mean, there's so much more about this movie. You know, you have Meshach Taylor as Kid's dad. You know, and those, for those who don't know Meshach Taylor, I mean, you know Meshach Taylor, don't get me wrong. You know, probably most famously as Hollywood from the Mannequin movies. And granted, at the end of the movie, and a few times during the movie, there are some, you know, what now would be considered some very inappropriate style risque jokes. They're not that awful, though, compared to what a lot of other stuff in the world goes along. But the way he plays it is just too good. It's just too good, and it's so fun seeing. And then also, you know, I forgot Demita, who is actually played by Alicia Rogers. She is originally Wedge's girlfriend, and then she falls for a kid's character, Duncan, when she thinks he's Blade, because of the switch that they have. And it's very easy to kind of shake the character off as typical, you know, 90s comedy, high school, like, who cares, I'm the cool kid fair. But it's kind of actually a nuanced performance that you wouldn't expect. You know, because they do that whole thing where, like, you know, she works at the Wax Museum and she actually cares about it and she's really good at actually creating things. But they don't play it in the way where it's just like trying to show you, oh, she's something special. It's just like, it's legit. It's like, it's a character who has this thing, and it's so perfectly real for what they built around it. You know, class act does not get the credit it deserves. I don't know why. I think, again, people, maybe they got burnt out already on Kid and Play at that point, or they were waiting for something else. Class Act is, and it's one of those movies where, I mean, again, I don't know what the Rotten Tomatoes score means now, because I don't know when people started reviewing it, but it's one of those things you look at and the Rotten Tomatoes score is like 13, but the audience score is 74, and the audience score is much more in line with what it should be. And, you know, most of the time I'm, you know, kind of the opposite, but not just being a critic, just because it just falls in line that way. But people either misunderstood or just like didn't care for whatever reason. Class Act's a great movie. Go see it, rent it, buy it, whatever you want, watch it. It's so good. So good. It's classic, and it's classic in a way that, again, there are other films that are similar, whether it's storyline or atmosphere, just being part of the genre in that sense, but it's still different when you think about it. Or when you go back and you try to compare it to other things, it had a lot more smarts behind it than I think people gave it credit for, or give it credit for, and they should go back and reevaluate it because it deserves it. And so with that, everybody go cross Class Act off your overdue rentals list, go watch it and then cross it off your list. In the Weeds, again, premiering this weekend at the Harlem Film Festival. Look in the description for information on how you can go see it. If you need to find us out there, you can email us at overduerentals@gmail.com. Find us where all your podcasts are found, Apple, Spotify, doesn't make a difference, you know, Podbean, go out there, you know, search us up, just look up Overdue Rentals. You'll find us. If it doesn't show us, just look up Overdue Rentals Movies. You'll find us. We're there. Let us know what you think. Give us your thoughts on In the Weeds. Give us your thoughts on Class Act, and then, come and join us. We'll be here. Bye-bye.